Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the ninth program in our series this year to broadcast this at this time on the third Friday of each month. We're featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. Our conversation today is election reflections. What just happened here? This month, as we do in November each election year, we'll reflect on the recent elections, what happened here and why, what does it mean for Maine? The show was pre-recorded on November 14th. Send your comments to news at weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum today. And let me introduce our guests. We've got some wonderful people joining our conversation. Nick Jacobs is the Assistant Professor of Government at Colby College. He is one of the country's leading experts on the rural-urban divide, federalism, and developments in the American party system. Welcome, Nick. Anna Keller is Executive Director of the League of Women Voters of Maine. They bring a background of conflict studies and pro-democracy campaigns around the world to the mission of making democracy work right here in Maine. Welcome, Anna.
Thanks for having me back.
Abby Kisa is Deputy Director of CIRCLE, the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. Abby is an expert on youth civic and political engagement. Welcome, Abby.
Hello, thank you.
And Steve Missler is the Chief Political Correspondent and State House Bureau Chief for Maine Public. He's an award-winning journalist who has been covering the Maine political scene for what? I don't want to make this number too big, but like two decades.
It's two decades, yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks
okay.
for having me. Appreciate
well,
it.
I'll give you a minute, Steve. I'm going to put the first question to you, but let's get started. The dust hasn't quite settled. We still got an RCV count. We got some recounts happening. But, you know, how does Election Day look to you from a week out?
Well, for Maine, it's a little bit different than it looks across the rest of the country, which, you know, I think objectively is basically a red wave that swept across the country with the election of former President Donald Trump. And in Maine, much of New England too, but Maine in particular, Democrats are able to hold on to their majorities in the legislature. It appears there's still some recounts that may further trim those majorities potentially. But it looks like, you know, they've gone ahead and elected leaders there. And in terms of the congressional delegation, you know, Shelley Pingree in the first congressional district won her reelection handily. So did Senator Angus King, who is an independent but caucuses with Democrats. Currently, it appears as though Jared Golden he's in a good position to hold on to that second congressional district seat, which for a while was seen as a really pivotal nationally for Democrats if they could hold on to the U.S. House. But that doesn't appear to be the case any longer, but still an important seat for Maine, obviously, and for Maine Democrats. And that's heading into that's currently in the midst of a ranked choice voting runoff as we speak.
We're taping on Thursday, so the ranked choice voting count is still going on. It may or may not be settled by the time this program airs tomorrow afternoon, Friday. You know, I want to talk about turnout and outcomes and meaning and how do we craft meaning out of this, but let's maybe take some of the simpler topics first, like the mechanics. We are not seeing stolen vote accusations, are we, Nick?
No, I think one of the most surprising things about this election is that here we are a week and 2 days out, and we're actually able to talk about the results when so many of us were thinking that we were going to be in a long, drawn out process of recounts, possible even that some states wouldn't even have their first tally done. And yet we woke up Wednesday morning and knew the outcome. Some of that is, as Steve said, function of the fact that Donald Trump won an outright majority of the national vote and won an outright majority of the votes cast in various states. And that's also part of the reason why we are not seeing accusations of a stolen election or rigged election. All the mysterious voters that were going to cast ballots illegally end of October, beginning of November, I guess they didn't show up. We haven't heard about them since then. In the week, you know, I've read some newspaper reports and some stories trying to draw this false equivalency of some concerns that Harris supporters have I do think it's a false equivalency. I think the people making those types of claims about, oh, if Musk was involved in rigging the vote, that's a very small minority of Harris supporters, where we shouldn't lose sight of the fact. And I don't think this is a partisan statement. It was a mainstream talking point by the presidential candidate that the election could have been rigged. It's not mainstream among Harris supporters. It was mainstream among Trump supporters, but those concerns have all but evaporated now.
How did it play out at the polling places, Anna? What did we see here in Maine? And are we hearing chaos from polling places around the country?
Our overall response in Maine was very good. We saw high voter turnout in most places, which may not have been the case every place in the country. We're still need to wait until we have the full results to do detailed analysis of that. But we had observers in over 120 polling places in 16 counties, and we had, over 220 polling places, in all 16 counties. And what they saw overall was that the elections were well conducted. People were enthusiastic to be there, but mostly following the rules, and that the process was well done. We did see occasional issues with voters who were harassing other voters. We saw some reports of intimidation against voters of color. This is something we haven't had reported in Maine before. And so even though those were isolated incidents, it's still something that caused us a lot of concern and something we are definitely watching for and calling on candidates in the future to denounce when that happens.
So, Steve, what's left to decide? How many races are going to recount, and when's that going to wrap up?
Well, I think the latest from the Secretary of State was that there are 11 recounts, and those are all for legislative races, if I recall correctly. And it looks like those will be, and I'll just check my notes real quick. I think most of those will be staggered over the end of this week and then the beginning of next week, with a couple actually taking place the day after. It looks like the day after Thanksgiving and even into the 25th. So two of those are Senate seats that are pretty close, District 8, which is Orono and a bunch of other towns outside of that. And then there's the Augusta Senate seat too, which is also heading to a recount. It doesn't look just with my experience with recounts that, you know, at the end of the day, usually it's not that many votes end up flipping or change. The results don't end up changing all that much. So, you know, unless there's, you know, the margins are super tight, you know, single digits or even a couple of dozen, you don't usually see changes in the preliminary results. So it's just kind of a due diligence check, you know, make sure everything looks okay. And usually the people that are ahead end up staying that way. That means, again, that looks like the Democrats will hold the Senate and in the House. And although their majorities are going to be a lot smaller, you know, and that is going to have some implications, I think, for the policy that runs out of the legislature. You know, over the past 6 years, Democrats have had stronger majorities for the most part. And of course, Democratic Governor Janet Mills, which has allowed them to push through pretty much anything they want for the most part. I mean, there's differences within the party and, you know, between progressives and your sort of main, your moderate Democrats, of which the governor is one. And so they, you know, they haven't pushed a lot of real progressive policies to, I think, the chagrin of progressive activists. But at the same time, I would expect that dynamic will shift even more to the middle now, especially when it comes to budgeting and that sort of stuff, because A, the Maine's budget picture looks a lot different now. There's a projected shortfall coming up. And then, of course, you know, you just have to be, when you have majorities that are that narrow, you have to listen to the minority party a little bit more because you may need their votes. And that's something that the Democrats really didn't have to do the past 6 years for the most part.
So before we go on to sort of broadly what this means, I just want to do a quick calendar check. Steve, I think the recounts are going to wrap up by the 25th, which is the week before Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is the 28th.
Oh, is it? Oh, my God. All right. Well, I thought Thanksgiving was next week. Thank you for that. Appreciate it.
And one of those races, it's actually tied, right?
Yeah, it's the House District 141. which is the Sanford race, which was in the news prior to the election because the Republican candidate had gotten himself into some legal trouble. I don't know if that's been entirely resolved yet, but Lucas Lanigan is the Republican, and he's currently tied with Patricia Kidder, the Democrat, and it's a dead heat. You know, there's like no difference. So that's one where a recount will make a difference.
And so, I mean, the recount finds one vote on either side, and that determines the winner. But if it's still a tie after the recount, what do they do? Does it go to the legislature? They flip a coin or what?
I actually don't know what happened. Okay. I've never seen a tie before. So you caught me cold on that one, Anne.
Sorry, it just occurred to me. So, I mean, a lot of the stuff that we expected, I mean, the outcome was surprising to some people, but we did not see wholesale voter challenges like we might have expected to see, Anna. There was, you know, rumors flying around that poll watchers were going to be issuing wholesale challenges of voters. That didn't come up, did it?
It didn't. And one of the things that's interesting when we look at trust in elections, and especially how this is in Maine, is that people tend to have very strong trust in their own election officials and how the elections are run in their own towns. And I think that is reflected when you see poll workers sitting, poll watchers sitting there, seeing the process. It tends to build confidence. And so we didn't see that kind of response. What we are continuing to keep an eye out, though, for is the policy changes. And I'm sure we'll talk about the referendum that was trying to qualify to be on the ballot that would make it harder for people to vote in several ways. And so as we think about where there might be threats to voters being able to participate in the future, we didn't see that kind of election day challenges from observers, but we're looking nonetheless toward what some potential policy changes or threats down the road might be.
Abby, I saw you nodding along to a couple of those things about challenges and voter confidence in their local officials. Do you want to weigh in on this mechanics and how it all ran question?
I just was agreeing with Anna's brilliance in talking about that and talking about the fact that the trust issue, I think a lot of people are trying to get to the bottom of this trust issue right now. And, you know, that's something that we're looking at amongst young people as well. And the dynamic between what's happening in my community, right, and what's happening sort of out there is a difference that we're also investigating and really interested in trying to understand because it seems really important for how we move forward to strengthen democracy.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is election reflections. What just happened here? Our guests this afternoon are Anna Keller, Executive Director for the League of Women Voters of Maine, Abby Kisa, Deputy Director of Circle, Steve Missler, Chief Political Correspondent and State House Bureau Chief for Maine Public, and Nick Jacobs, Assistant Professor of Government at Colby College. This program was pre-recorded on November 14th. No listener calls are being taken right now. So, I mean, Steve started taking us into the outcomes and what's left to be decided. We've got divided government or unified government at the state level. I guess we've got unified government at both the state level and the federal level, only on opposite sides. How does this fit into the national political conversation, Nick? And where does New England fit? And what is, you know, conservative government going to mean for Maine? Comment on how this all sort of fits together into a political picture from your perspective.
Well, as of yesterday afternoon, we also now know that we have unified government at the national level. That was a little bit up in the air. And we're starting to get an early picture of how that's all going to play out under the new Trump administration. The Trump transition team has been quite speedy, both in comparison to other presidential transitions, but also to their 2016 transition in naming cabinet appointees. And the various leaders of different commissions. My son, I will tell listeners, is weighing in on these important developments as well. So if you hear babbling, that's why. You know, as we could expect, though, and as is common with any presidential transition, the victorious candidates and victorious parties celebrate in the immediate aftermath, and then the cracks start to form. With the announcement of some cabinet officials, we're starting to see Republicans that were very gleeful on Tuesday, Tuesday evening, Wednesday morning, beginning to cast some doubts on whether or not they're fully on board with some of what President Trump wants to do. And so I guess the short story is we need to wait and see how unified government's going to play out. There's aspects of it that do point to a red wave. The outright popular vote win was surprising for many people, but that does not mean that the Republican Party is necessarily unified and in lockstep and in agreement on everything. I think Maine fits into this in some really interesting ways because of who one of our senators is, Susan Collins. Susan Collins not only did not support Donald Trump in the presidential election, she has voted to impeach him during his first administration. She is a part of that Republican majority that makes up unified government, but I don't think we are going to expect her to march in lockstep with what the administration hopes to accomplish. I think Susan Collins is going to play a role in this Republican Senate majority, much like Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin played with a slim Democratic majority under the Biden administration. For that reason, you're starting to see some maneuvers by the Trump transition team in potentially bypassing Senate confirmation processes, taking advantage of a sort of reading loosely what the requirements for recess appointments are. And they are doing this knowing that their own party is going to act as a check on their ambitions. And the parts of the party that disagree with them the most.
Steve, you talked about a budget shortfall in Maine. What do you think the federal landscape means for Maine and its budget considerations? Do we have any insight on that?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is that, Nick had mentioned Senator Collins. I mean, she holds a pretty lofty position on the Appropriations Committee. I think there's some question as to whether or not she'll ascend to become the actual Senate chair of that committee, or if she'll get bumped by Senator Mitch McConnell. That'll be an interesting contest to see and view from afar. And in terms of what that means, what Republican control of federal government means for Maine in terms of what its budget looks like. I mean, Maine is pretty dependent on federal dollars. You could argue that a lot of its budget surpluses over the past couple of years, Maine runs on a 2-year budget cycle. So the past, 4 or 5 years, the state has been benefited from a surplus of federal cash in large part because of pandemic relief aid that Congress authorized. That money's not, we're not going to see that money this time around. And so, and in addition to that, I mean, I think Trump has signaled early that he wants to rein in federal spending, which could have some impacts on Maine in the programs that it funds. Mainly Medicaid is a huge one that could be problematic. Maine is an expansion state where it's expanded eligibility of that program to other people that other states have not. So that could be problematic for the state if there are cuts to that for any reason. And then there's all sorts of other policies like renewable energy policy, this offshore wind odyssey that the governor has embarked on that could be short circuited by a Trump administration. And then the immigration issue could be a flashpoint, too. Now, that's not related. Well, it's not related to state budget matters necessarily, but it has a profound impact on the state's economy. So, and it could have a ripple effect in the state's budget down the road if there's suddenly all kinds of deportations and a lot of these folks that have come, the new Mainers that have come to the state, are valuable contributors to the workforce just like they have been in other states. So a lot of concern about that, so we'll have to wait and see how it all pans out. But I think Nick's point about the Republicans and, you know, not being a unified party as it relates to Trump, I think this is a great one because you're already seeing that now with these cabinet appointments, some of which, many of which are confirmable, which would put the Senate and Senator Collins in a pretty tough position if some of these folks are objectionable to her, like the president's pick of Matt Gaetz, lawmaker from Florida, very controversial person. And, you know, I mean, Collins already said that she was shocked that the president would pick him to be attorney general, the U.S. attorney general. And so it seems like Matt Gaetz is in trouble. But who else may not be, who might be on the margins that might slip by because the president is exerting his will and pressure on a Republican caucus that in his first term was pretty compliant for the most part. So
I want to spend the second half of the show talking about the important factors and what the story is about how this happened and what it means. But before we do that, I just want to sort of wrap up what else has been decided and what's left to decide. So, Anna, the referendum questions, what happened there?
So the referendums, we saw that they all passed except for the flag, which is the question that we had all been paying perhaps the most attention to going in. Question one, which is restrictions around campaign spending, passed very strongly. That will now likely be challenged in court. The three bond questions all passed with some with narrow margins. And then the flag was defeated. So we are keeping the existing blue flag with the main state seal for the moment.
And what about constitutional officers? How does that work? And when will those be contested? How will they be decided?
Maine has an unusual system where our constitutional officers, the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, and the State Treasurer are elected by the combined Maine House and Senate. And so in this case, the combined houses have a Democratic majority between the two of them. And that means that most likely the holders of those offices will come from the Democratic Party. We expect that the existing Secretary of State, Shenna Bellows, will likely be re-elected into that position. There may be a contested attorney general race, that there has been some interest from multiple people in that seat. And so that will happen once the new legislature is sworn in. They will take those votes.
Steve, do you have any more comment on the election of the constitutional officers and how those will be contested?
No, I think Anna nailed it and knows a lot more about potential challengers to the AG than I did. Thanks for that.
And Trump won the popular vote. Now, Maine is a state that joined the Interstate Compact for a national popular vote and is interested in seeing the president elected nationally by the popular vote. Do you think that Trump having won the popular vote lends credence to getting rid of the Electoral College or undermines the case for getting rid of the Electoral College? Anna?
I have one comment on this, and I've been thinking about it, and I'm really curious how this will play out. I think, first of all, we shouldn't make an assumption about whether a system is working or not working based on one election result. We'd look at the results over time. But even though we did have the same winner of the Electoral College and the popular vote, we all lived through a campaign where only four or five, maybe six states got any attention from the presidential candidates. And so when we think about the kind of campaign that was run, the issues that were talked about, who was featured, who was seen to matter going into this election, the Electoral College still had an enormous impact on this campaign. And then because of that, perhaps still ends up with an enormous impact on who even the popular vote in other states are for than if there had been a truly national campaign run, if we had a system with a national popular vote being the deciding factor.
I see you nodding along there. Nick, do you want to weigh in on this?
Oh, I think that's absolutely right and really insightful that we had all of us experience what that election, what that campaign was like under those rules. I don't think it changed how people felt insofar as being heard or not heard or campaigned or not spoken to. I do think some of the wind is going to be taken out of the sails. But to Anna's point about long-term trends, it is still absolutely the case that right now how the electorate is composed and the Republican Party does have a partisan advantage in smaller states that tend to lean rural. The Electoral College isn't designed to give rural places, you know, an added say. It's designed to give smaller states an added say. But right now, the way the population in this country is changing, bigger states are getting bigger on the most, for the most part. Smaller states are getting smaller, and smaller states are trending rural. And that all gives the Republican Party a sort of built-in advantage that can change over time, but probably not going to go away anytime soon.
I've read that the voter participation differential between swing states and non-swing states is pretty significant. And is that something that Circle has looked at, voter participation across the states? Abby, go ahead, weigh in on that.
Absolutely. We always see sometimes some pretty major turnout differences by state. And we always see that states that are more competitive in the Electoral College definitely have higher turnout. We saw that again this year, specifically amongst young people 18 to 29. Our very early estimates suggest that turnout was 8 points higher in the seven swing states that we've been looking at. And, you know, when it comes to young people and the research on young people, it's, you know, it's pretty clear why that happens. There's much more conversation about the election. There's much more people doing outreach to folks about the election, right? There's more information on, around about it. So the conditions in which young people may be aging into an electorate, for example, are totally different than in a state where those may be decreased.
I mean, we've heard people in, let's say, a state that is dominated by one party, not a swing state. Let me take Connecticut, for example. I know people personally who just don't even bother because they think their vote doesn't count in Connecticut. I mean, so that's sort of what we're seeing play out with the voting differential, right?
I think, and it can be a different type of culture around voting and elections by state. We have some states where, you know, if you look at Minnesota, which isn't as much of a swing state, right? It isn't as much, it has some competitive elections, but statewide elections, but they have an extremely strong culture and have in the past and very recently proposed and passed what we would call very facilitative voter laws that really help people understand and make the system more accessible to a wider diversity of folks.
Let me take a station break, then I want to come back and talk about the important factors that led to the outcome of this election. So you're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Abby Kisa, Deputy Director at Circle, Steve Missler, Chief Political Correspondent and State House Bureau Chief for Maine Public, Nick Jacobs, Assistant Professor of Government at Colby Cobb College, and Anna Keller, Executive Director for the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is election reflections. What just happened here? This show was pre-recorded. Send your comments or questions to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. A reminder, we're recording this conversation on December 14th when the ranked choice voting count in CD2 is still underway. By the time this airs, that race may or may not have been determined. So let's talk about what the important factors were and how we make sense of the election, our main takeaways. You know, Steve characterized this sort of as a Republican wave, but turnout was actually pretty low nationwide, right? Who would like to just comment on what you make sense of who turned out, who participated, why they participated, who won, why, who lost, and why? Just a general comment. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, I'll start because I think the story that I've been able to tell or that I've told the last two election cycles about our political geography and our geographic divides is different this time around. Whereas in 2016 and 2020, when it comes to turnout and who turns out and who was pivotal, it was all about rural voters. Rural voters in a handful of states like Michigan and Wisconsin, first breaking for Trump, then coming back. And the story this time around is non-rural voters. And when you want to, if you look at states like Pennsylvania, what really explains Trump's margin of victory in Pennsylvania, why we were able to call Pennsylvania so early, it's because year-over-year turnout in the Philadelphia suburbs and Pittsburgh was tens of thousands of voters less. So it wasn't so much a persuasion of, there was some persuasion of suburban and urban voters, but a lot of this just had to do with the fact that some people stayed home. And we know that was a part of the story, at least in Michigan, where a lot of focus was focused on Dearborn, Michigan, where a community of Arab Americans sat out the race in protest of the Biden and Harris administration's policies of Israel and Gaza. And so I think there's a lot of stories like that around the country, even though turnout was high. A lot of people prior to Election Day said that, you know, it matters who wins this election. We're going to be focused on it, you know, for hundreds of thousands of others of Americans. They said, not important enough, or I'm going to exercise and protest vote by staying home.
What are you seeing among youth vote? I mean, we've all been expecting high turnout among young people. Their futures are at stake. What did we see in this election, Abby?
I think we saw a couple of things. One, we saw data that suggests that civic engagement is learned and that it takes multiple election cycles to build up a strong youth electorate. We saw in 2018 and 2020 the impact of having full years of engagement amongst young people talking about politics and talking about election and what that did to historic turnout in those years. We did not see that as much in 2022. And I think that that had an impact on 2024. We also saw amongst young people a different youth electorate in 2024 than we saw in 2020. We saw a more Republican youth electorate, which illuminated was just a reminder to a lot of people about the diversity and ideology amongst young people that we've seen in data for a long time. But this time, those young people were the young people who were more likely to show up. Much of that shift appears to be driven by young men who voted for Biden in 2020, but Trump in 2024, and in particular, young white men. I can dig even deeper into that and share more about that. But those are a couple of the initial takeaways that we're seeing from the election.
I mean, I'd ask you to go a little deeper, Abby, because I think we're all curious why that happened.
Yeah. So, you know, we're actually in the midst of doing a bunch of analysis about, you know, young folks who voted for Trump. And so I can't share as much as I would really like to, but, you know, a bunch of the past, you know, several months, there's been conversations about gender and young voters. And the data that we have available allows us to disaggregate by young men, non-binary folks and young women. And non-binary folks were by far major Harris supporters. Young men voted for Trump in 2024 and young women supported Harris. The data by gender and race shows something pretty different. There was largely the shift towards Trump was driven by young men who voted for Trump by a 28-point margin. And if we look even closer into it, we see that more of the young men who turned out identified as Republican, 52% identified as Republicans among young white men who showed up. And there were also increases in sort of the identification with the Republican Party amongst the young men of color who showed up. So that's a pretty significant change in the youth electorate, because in 2020, 47% of young people who showed up for the election identified as Democrat. those are some of the things that we're analyzing and trying to dig more into, including what issues those young people cared about, what their policy positions are. And, you know, I think we'll see that while that it doesn't necessarily really match, as we've seen before earlier this year in some of our polling data, that young people who are supportive of Trump don't necessarily always match with older folks who are supporting Trump, nor necessarily with kind of a traditional kind of Republican or conservative mindset, but with this sort of new take on what the Republican Party is.
Steve, what are we seeing or what are you observing around the differences between CD1 and CD2 in terms of the electorate voter turnout and the attitudes?
Yeah, I mean, I think CD2 is an interesting case in and of itself because, and people may not remember this. I mean, I think everybody on this panel would, but, you know, that's a district that went and voted for President Obama twice, like convincingly. And, you know, and Trump was the first to flip that district and actually get an electoral vote out of it in 2016. And he did that in large part, I guess, by, you know, turning out disaffected voters who were upset about various, you know, mill closures and trade policies that are associated with that. And, you know, I don't know that there's been that big of a shift in the second congressional district. I mean, statewide, Harris did just about as well as Biden did in 2020. So there wasn't, I didn't notice a big shift in Maine between the two congressional districts or in their preferences or their voting behavior. But I confess to not having dug into that in any great detail. It's not, no exhaustive analysis on my part. But, you know, it is interesting. I think what Abby was saying about the youth vote is really intriguing to me because I know I'm shifting gears a little bit, but because the youth male vote is interesting because I've seen right-wing activists targeting that vote over the last several years, and it appears as though that may have paid off. I mean, we're seeing some of that even in Maine with an activist group that also runs a news service of sorts, you know, and they're really that person and that group basically are targeting young men in a lot of ways. And you could see that nationally as well. And, you know, and just nationally, too, you'd see, you know, there was a big deal about how the former President Trump was doing all these interviews with podcasters like Joe Rogan and that sort of thing. I think this is all part of the plan. Right. And it looks as though from Abby's description of, you know, some of the findings that her organization have produced suggests that it may have been successful, you know, and that's very interesting. I guess the question is whether that can be sustained or not over the long haul.
The one thing that I do want to jump in on, if that's okay, is the Maine context, because while we saw a shift generally in states towards Trump amongst young people, amongst the youth electorate who showed up in 2024 compared to 2020, we saw something different in Maine. You know, this is based on the AP Votecast survey that's done during election week, and there are larger margins of error for states with lower populations. But what we saw in Maine is that there was even more of a Democratic bent to the youth electorate in Maine, right? Which is not what we saw in other states, which is very interesting. Unfortunately, we won't have state turnout until the winter and be able to really, you know, understand those dynamics a little bit more, which will be really important to understanding, you know, what we really saw nationally.
Nick, I'm not sure if you're the one to answer this question, but I'm going to ask you anyway, which has to do with how the information ecosystem, and this is alluding to a little bit what Steve was saying, how the information ecosystem is shifting away from mainstream media and print media toward the blogosphere and, you know, online social media commentary, and whether you think that's having a disparate effect across the two parties.
Yeah, I you asked me. I think I actually used the word newspaper,
Print
newspaper earlier in the conversation. So, but right, part of the story of this this campaign, this election season, is the podcast. This is the podcast campaign. Donald Trump turning down last minute a high profile interview with one of the most prestigious legacy news shows, 60 Minutes, in order to go spend time with Joe Rogan talking about whatever, and getting tens of millions of views within a week. The media landscape is shifting. It's not surprising that an unconventional candidate like Trump, and somebody that's been tapped into developments in the media, would have his finger on the pulse. I think that's part of the reason why maybe you're seeing shifts in the youth vote. And, you know, the Harris campaign, I don't think responded as aggressively to that. You know, her notable media appearance was that she was able to sit down with a Fox News journalist during prime time and tried to make some inroads into that audience. May have backfired. It's always hard to, how much you can really attribute to a single interview or single story. But where those candidates position themselves and how they tried to appeal to the persuadable voters was different. And I wouldn't be surprised if in the next couple of months or years, we get a much clearer picture that it made a difference, that this wasn't so much about, it was almost like they were talking past one another because they were just talking to different segments of the electorate.
I've also read that Twitter, for now known as X, lost like X number of users after the election, which people attribute to Russian bots sort of dropping off the format. How much do you think our voters were actually targeted by foreign governments?
Well, we're still gathering information on that. We know that foreign governments had active disinformation campaigns. We know that they were continuing campaigns of disinformation that were active in 2016, if not before, active in 2020. Some of that, I'll add this point too, that although I think foreign disinformation campaigns are certainly problematic and a threat to the stability of democracy, domestic disinformation campaigns are perhaps more consequential because they're harder to detect. They're everywhere. You know, the amount of money spent in these races from outside groups that bypass traditional, what we would think of as traditional fundraising and disclosure mechanics and weren't actually affiliated with one campaign, but were in effect running shadow campaigns, right? That just pumped voters with different messages. Candidates themselves were accused, not equally, but were accused of drumming up disinformation. We spent the better part of the single presidential debate we had talking about myths of what Haitians in Springfield, Ohio were doing and not doing. So I just close on that point that, you know, we should rightfully be concerned about foreign disinformation, but we should also be concerned about what we're doing to ourselves.
I'm going to take a short break. And then, Steve, I want to let you comment on the media environment because you, after all, are in the media. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Nick Jacobs, Assistant Professor of Government at Colby College, Anna Keller, Executive Director for the League of Women Voters of Maine, Abby Kisa, Deputy Director at Circle, and Steve Missler, Chief Political Correspondent and State House Bureau Chief for Maine Public. This program was pre-recorded on November 14th. No listener calls are being taken right now. So, Steve, yeah, the media environment, like, can democracy work in a media environment like this? What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting because I've had a lot of conversation with friends and acquaintances over the last week or so about you know, questions of relevance. Are we relevant any longer? You know, people who do what I do. I don't think so after an election like this, because I don't know that people are coming to us to get their information. And, you know, that's a question we're going to have to wrestle with as news organizations. I think it's very problematic. You know, and related to that, you know, Nick had mentioned all this, you know, misinformation and disinformation that's swirling around out there, whether it's domestic or foreign. I mean, so much of our job is dispelling or disproving a lot of that stuff or setting the record straight. I got to tell you, it's impossible. It's too much. It's just to call it a fire hose would not be describing it accurately. It's just you know, to check a lot of these claims and everything else is just an impossible job. And even when you do it, there's almost no reward for having done that. You know, so I don't know how news organizations, we have our own problems in terms of just staying viable financially. I'm fortunate enough to be part of a public media ecosystem where that's less of a problem, at least for now, but who knows? But you know, in the commercial media, it's a huge issue. And I don't know how it gets solved necessarily, because at the end of the day, you know, people are making a choice of where to get their information. You know, some people are getting it on TikTok, they're getting it on Instagram or X, or, I mean, I just created a new social media account that makes three that I have to monitor, one for all the right wing stuff on X, another one for the mainstream on Threads, and another one for the left on Blue Sky. And it's all, you know, for the most part, it's not great. It's just trash. But we've got to sift through it. And unfortunately, a lot of people go there to get their information. And that's that. I don't know how you change that. I keep joking that we're hurtling towards a post-literate society. And I don't know where that leaves the traditional media. But that's not such a rosy outlook, but that's the way I feel about it at the moment.
Yeah. Anna, you posted something in the chat. Go ahead, say it on the air.
Just on the question of Twitter and X and bots, I've noticed, you know, people in my environment choosing in the last week to say, no, I'm really, really done this time. I'm going to move over entirely to Blue Sky, or I'm going to move to Threads. I'm deleting my account on X.
Yeah.
That was a response directly to the political power of Elon Musk, where before people were saying, oh, this app is getting worse and worse, but somehow I'm still here, that was a response. And it reminds me of the wave of people unsubscribing from the Washington Post after them not making an endorsement. And whether we see, do those people come back? Where do they go? What, you know, what does all of that shifting look like? That there's a real suspicion of the influence of, you know, billionaires and corporate influence, but that there's also such low trust in institutions of just about every kind. And I think that goes right along with the question of why podcasts are so popular, why TikTok is popular. People want to trust other people, whether that they make those judgments, you know, on good basis or not. But I think almost anything that is trying to rely on institutional legacy is at a disadvantage, including organizations like the League in a lot of ways. And so that's something we think a lot about. There was a lot of focus in political circles around voter turnout this time, talking about the importance of relational organizing and connecting with your friends and family, because that's really the only way that we were going to have any influence over people. So I'm seeing that thread of person to person. And even in the response to this election, I'm also seeing a lot of the responses being a debate about, what do you do right now? Do you join an organization, or do you try to connect directly with your friends and family in your community? And I don't think those things are in opposition, but there's a debate that's happening about what is the best way to organize and to react, especially for people who are opposed to the incoming administration. So I see all of those different threads connecting here. And it does really leave us with a lot more questions than answers about what both organizing and media look like.
Does your research touch on this, Abby?
Coming from a democracy perspective, and how do we expand who is participating? You know, obviously there are, as folks have talked about, significant concerns about misinformation. And I also want to say that I don't think that I don't think that the need to communicate with people in multiple channels is inherently an issue, right? Because we actually have some pretty significant inequalities in this country when it comes to access to civic information and access to supports to be engaged in civic life. And so I do think that we have to think differently about how are we bringing people in. Maybe it's okay that the Washington Post is on Instagram reaching a whole bunch of people that way, right? And that we need that in order to be able to bring in a much more diverse electorate than we have had. So I guess I just wanted to bring that perspective, but obviously caveats, misinformation is really bad. Echo chambers are really bad. I just think that there's a bunch of different angles for thinking about it.
I mean, I read a survey a couple of weeks ago from U.gov that showed like 70% of people supported Harris's policies, but, obviously over 50% of voters chose Trump. So there's like this disconnect between what people are actually proposing and why people are supporting them. Does anybody want to comment on that in the context of how people get their information and what information they're getting? Go ahead, Nick, I'll put you on the spot.
My take is a little different. I think one way you could solve that maybe paradox or irony, which Democrats mostly have talked about for decades. I mean, I first read about it in the context of the George W. Bush administration. Why are people voting for tax cuts that go overwhelmingly to the wealthy? And there's no shortage of books trying to explain why people, quote, vote against their self-interest, and that some of this may have to do with the information people are receiving or not receiving, the framing of the message. And I think political consultants are going to continue making money off of that debate in the near future. I have a slightly different take, which is that I do think people make sense of policy the best they can. I think they make sense of policy better than they're often given credit for. But they're complex. Voters contain multitudes. And even if you like one candidate's policy, let's say on healthcare, which we know something like the Affordable Care Act is favored and its popularity has risen ever since it was enacted, you may vote for a candidate that wants to repeal the Affordable Care Act, not because you have been duped, not because you don't know where they stand, but because other issues are more important. Or as I have written about quite a bit in the context of just rural voting, you just have a fundamental distrust of the person or the party that is promoting those policies. I don't think most voters go into the voting booth with a laundry list of policies that they check off and then they tally it's right on the other, even if they do have some sense of the policy. What I think most voters look at is they look at the general message that a party or a candidate is sending. They think about how that message, their internal memory about politics. Right now, the story is that this narrative about the Democratic Party being a party that is removed from everyday concerns, a party that's increasingly coastal, college educated. This is a story that I think more voters are telling themselves, and that is what is driving some of this class divide. So that's my brief take.
Well, we're kind of running out of time, and I promised you each a minute or so to wrap up. So I'm going to start the clock on that now. Give Abby the first run at it. What's your closing comment here today?
Yeah, thanks so much, Anne. I really appreciate it. I think people are reacting to the election in a lot of ways. And, I just wanted to hold space for that. I also just want to remind people that there's so many ways in which we can incorporate and invite young people into participating in democracy between elections. So many different ways. And that exposure to decision making about your own community can be so powerful to keep someone involved, to let someone know that their experiences matter, right? And they're qualified to participate in these conversations can go a real long way with the millions and millions of young people who turn 18 every single year.
Good. Thank you, Abby. Go ahead, Steve, you go next.
You know, I just will just reiterate some of the things I've said during the course of the program. And thanks, Anne, for inviting me on. You know, I think the election, you know, it raises as many questions as it answered for a lot of people on, you know, and what it means for Maine, what it means for the country, what is democracy in election, in elections, what do they look like after this? I think that's a big question on everybody's mind. And, you know, from my perspective as a member of the press and the media, you know, I think there's the question for us is how do we reach people and better and more of them? And again, that's a question of, I think we all need to question our relevance in the democratic process these days and how we become more relevant. And I don't know what that looks like necessarily, but, those are the things that are on my mind.
Go ahead, Anna, take your turn.
I'm reflecting on the difference between an election that mechanically worked very well and the broader flaws in our democracy that we're talking about with misinformation, with structural issues. And it reminds me that we have to be working on those pieces as well, that we can get very focused on making sure that people are able to vote. And that is absolutely essential. But if people don't believe that their vote is going to matter for any number of the reasons that we've discussed, they're not going to vote. And so, you know, there's a role for candidates and political parties in figuring that out. But when I think about the league and our space, what can we do on a structural basis to make sure that people know that their votes will really matter? That they are in a competitive elections, that there won't be spoilers, that we won't have the Electoral College in the way. And I think that despite all of the shocks and surprises of this election and all of the things that we might think about differently, I do think that those same structural flaws are being reflected in the fact that we are seeing election after election that are change elections and uh-huh. that people are frustrated, and they're looking for ways to show that frustration. And what I think we can all agree on is that there is a real call for things to be done differently. So I think about how we can channel that into pro-democracy ways.
Nick, we're running out of time, but I would want to give you one last shot.
Well, thank you for having me. I always remind myself that the great observer of American democracy, Alexis de Tocqueville, called presidential elections periods of intrigue and agitation and a national crisis, right? We're divided into hostile camps. They do inflame our tensions and our passions. But the real work of governance happens later. I think people, once the campaign dies down, you know, that I like Anna's point, you know, whether you voted for Harris or voted for Trump, a lot of their supporters were really voting against the other person. A lot of their supporters have some common ground. We'll wait to see if our political system is actually going to respond to, I think, where that common ground, or if we'll just start talking about the next presidential election next month. You know, somebody's going to run.
That's our show for today. Thank you to our guests this afternoon, Nick Jacobs, Assistant Professor of Government at Colby College, Anna Keller, Executive Director for the League of Women Voters of Maine, Steve Missler, Chief Political Correspondent and State House Bureau Chief at Maine Public, Abby Kisa from Circle. So thank you all so much for joining us. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. We're streaming at WERU.org. If you have a comment about this show, send it to news@WERU.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League website is lwvme.org for more information about this topic or to learn about other shows in our series. You can subscribe to our podcast at lwvme.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next month.